Finally, we can get this week started. Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Delighted to get to be with you. As always, particularly grateful because of your generosity to us last week, which assured us that we are fully funded for the next 3 months. Eases everybody's mind around here. Now we can just get back to doing what we love doing, which is talk about Jesus, talk about his church, talk about God, talk about the Virgin Mary. And those last two we're going to talk about in the 2 hours today. In the second hour, William Albrecht will be with us. You might know him from the Reason and Theology podcast, among his other things that he does. And we're going to ask him about the Assumption of Mary, because the Feast of the Assumption of Mary is a week from today. And so we'll ask about, where do we get this idea? How do we justify this as Catholics? And if it's not something you're comfortable with, this Catholic doctrine of the Assumption of Mary, perfect hour for you to call and have a conversation with William Albrecht, who has studied Mary in the Bible and in the Church Fathers extensively. This hour, what about the argument that we hear? I don't know if it's in itself an argument, but it is certainly supported by arguments. When you're on the internet and then that person comes on and goes, it's irrational. This belief in God is an irrational belief. There's no justification for it. There's no way. Like, why do you believe in God? That kind of thing. I always refer people to experts on that. That's like, I believe in God because, and then I just give a link or something. But some people can actually have these conversations because they're smart, they've studied it, and they can think on their feet. And among those is our guest, Pat Flynn, who is an associate apologist here at Catholic Answers. He does philosophy for the people on the internet. You can check out philosophy, just put in philosophy for the people, and you will come to it. And he's also father of, I don't know, how many kids now? How many kids now, Pat Flynn?
Five, father as of 3 weeks ago, Cy.
And a Taekwondo black belt, and also, yeah, he is. Did you know that? Yeah. And a kettlebell enthusiast. He's really strong. Pat Flynn, thanks for being with us.
It's always my pleasure, Cy, and thank you for letting me know that my employment is secure for the next 3 months as well. That's awesome to hear.
That's the main thing for us. We were like, we got to do this for Pat. We got to get Pat Flynn secure for the next 3 months because another new baby came. Five kids, and one of them is brand new into this world.
That's right.
Does she like this world so far? How's she responding to it?
She's an absolute joy. You know, she sleeps actually phenomenally well. She's our first child that is a tremendous sleeper. Now, look, all the other children, they still keep me awake at night. So don't take that as me being well rested. But Briga Magdalena is her name. She's a joy, and I keep telling this story, but I have to mention it again real quick. She had a mermaid birth, meaning she was born on call or in the fully intact amniotic sac, which I didn't even know was a thing. But apparently,
I've never
that happens.
Even heard of that.
Yeah, I didn't know. It's kind of crazy, but apparently that happens one in every 80,000 births or so. So yeah, it was
she's
pretty exciting
special.
Stuff.
Wow. So does she get any special skills with that? Can she breathe underwater?
She'll be clairvoyant.
She'll be clairvoyant. Very good.
Yeah, that's what we were told.
I'll tell you what, if you're not a believer, or maybe you're an atheist, maybe you call yourself an agnostic, maybe you think there is no rational reason to believe in God, maybe even you believe it's irrational or unreasonable to believe in God. If that is you, we'll put you to the top of the line. But anybody who would like to talk with Pat Flynn about arguments for God's existence, about the fact of God's existence, is welcome to call 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. So yeah. I assume that in your work doing philosophy for the people, people must make at least some good arguments against God's existence. I don't know that I would ever be so confident, no matter how atheist I was, to go on the internet and say to people, it's irrational for you to believe in God. That seems like a stretch to me, but they must have some good arguments. You want to share some of the best ones?
Yeah, I'll share too. But let me say something quickly about the notion that it's irrational to believe in God. And here I just like to appeal to authority. And I don't think it's fallacious to do in this instance, because I'm appealing to relevant authorities. If you go to philosophers in philosophy of religion, those people who really study the question of God's existence and engage in worldview debates, I find very few, if any, on the atheist side who think that belief in God is irrational, that they think it's like crazy. Now, most of them will say, yeah, I don't believe in God, or here's my reasons of why I'm a philosophical naturalist. But many, I mean, the top tier philosophers who are atheistic, who are relevantly qualified in this area anyways, the vast majority of them say, no, it's perfectly reasonable to believe in God. So I just like to like make that clear. Like the best people on the opposing team who are most qualified, they don't tend to make this assertion. They don't tend to say that it's irrational to believe in God, right?
I'm so glad to hear you make that point, because ever since Richard Dawkins's book, The God Delusion, came out in the early 2000s, I mean, to use the phrase delusion with such kind of brash confidence, I think empowered a lot of people to go with the "this is just crazy, why do you believe in God" argument. But that's it's fascinating and helpful for, I think, to point out that the people who really work at this, they don't say their opponents or the people with the other view are irrational. They just they may be unbelievers, but they're not accusers, I suppose, in that way.
Right, because they understand the debate is far more nuanced and technical and complicated, and that there are many arguments put forth for the existence of God. I mean, I'll give you one example. There's a philosopher, was, God rest him, he's passed away. His name is William Rowe, and he's well known for advancing the problem of evil, a specific version of it called the evidential problem of evil. Now, you ask me, what do I think are the best arguments against God? This would be one of them, right? But my good friend, Professor Jim Madden, who co-hosts Philosophy for the People with me, he was a student of Bill Rowe. And Bill Rowe had told him many times how reasonable he thought belief in God was, especially if you thought something like the principle of sufficient reason was true. If you thought that the world was sort of fully intelligible and that there was an adequate explanation for essentially why anything exists and why it has the sort of attributes it does, he thought that it makes perfect sense to be a theist. Now, he had his own reasons of why he doesn't accept the principle of sufficient reason, but he'd be one of those examples of somebody who would be more gracious in this sort of debate. And again, I think it's just important to point that out, because that guy was not an idiot, right? He was very smart.
Right.
Very smart.
And he made one of the best arguments against God, but he didn't think you were an idiot for believing in God.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Now you asked about arguments that are made against the existence of God, and there's two that stand out to me, and they're actually the two that Aquinas considers in his Summa. And this is kind of interesting about Aquinas, because when he considers objections to a position, if anybody's familiar with how Aquinas works, he always considers objections first, and then he tries to systematically rebut them. Often he's got like a laundry list of objections to a position that he's considering. You know, sometimes he might have like 10 or 15 objections. But for the existence of God, he only considers two. He only considers two. And those two objections are the problem of evil. Hey, if God is all good and God is all powerful, then why is the world like it is, with all this suffering and evil? Doesn't evil itself sort of contradict God, or doesn't it count as strong evidence against God? So yeah, call one of those I think challenging arguments against God the problem of evil, and it comes in different forms. The second one, which people might be a little bit less familiar with, says essentially this: hey, the principles of nature are enough. God is a sort of God is superfluous in terms of hypothesis, right? We don't need God to make sense of the world. And in a sort of more modern representation, it might say something like this: naturalism and theism actually explain just as much. They're on an explanatory par. But naturalism is simpler, and we should believe the simpler theory. If they, you know, if things are on a par, other things equal, we should believe the simpler theory. So we should just believe naturalism, right? Because it's simpler and explains just as much as theism. Now, that doesn't prove that God exists. It's a sort of more modest argument, but it's trying to give weight to a naturalistic worldview over a theistic worldview. So those, if you were to ask me, which you did, what I think are the biggest challenges or the best arguments against the existence of God, I would give you those two, which are, of course, the two that Aquinas considers. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Pat Flynn is our guest. Philosophy for the People is his podcast. You're welcome to call 888-318-7884. We're talking about, well, is it unreasonable to believe in God? If that's something that you believe, if you think that we're making a serious intellectual error by believing in God. We'd love to have that conversation. You're very, very welcome here. As a matter of fact, you go to the front of the line if you're an atheist or agnostic person, or if there's another word that you use for it, that's fine, but you get the idea. If you don't believe in God, 888-318-7884. If you're one of our Catholic brother or Christian brothers or sisters or believer of another sort and you'd just like some help answering these objections, you're also welcome to call. You're just not getting put up to the top of the line. 888-318-7884.
Catholic Answers Live. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
One of the reasons we should go to Mass is because it is the food of the saints that we receive. And for the saints, they understood rightly that the time after Holy Communion, that those moments are the most precious moments of our lives.
The Holy Sacrifice of the Mass, live from the EWTN Chapel, every morning, 8 Eastern, on EWTN Radio and Television.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We have a policy of letting Pat Flynn make the arguments against God's existence and then not tell us why he doesn't accept those. So, I can't believe that we did that, I did that. I just let you say, here's the strongest arguments against God, but I didn't let you explain why you don't accept those. But we'll, should we allow that as a tease that you're going
to
do that?
What a cliffhanger. Yeah, that'll keep people to the end of the episode at least,
okay,
right?
Okay, all right. So we'll explain why Pat doesn't accept those. The argument from evil or about suffering as contradicting the possibility of a good God's existence. And the argument that a natural explanation is perfectly adequate and we don't need that God explanation. You're welcome to call 888-318-7884 with your questions or challenges for Pat. And we'll start in St. Paul, Minnesota, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Eric in St. Paul, Minnesota, you are numero uno today. I just got to confirm what line you're. Okay, Eric, go ahead with your question for Pat Flynn.
Yeah, you know, I get into arguments with atheists, etc. I'll just say one thing I ask them, because they say there's no proof. I go, at Fatima, 90 days in advance, 3 10-year-old or younger children predict on October 13th there will be a giant miracle. 70,000 people show up, and the sun breaks through the rain and defies cosmic laws. It happens 90 days to... If they can't provide an answer how that could have happened without divine intervention, then I say they're being intellectually dishonest. I can't. If they want evidence, then there's lots of miracles. That's all I'll say for now.
All right, hang on.
That's the way I argue.
Let's get Pat's response.
Yeah, I think that this is Fatima is a very powerful consideration. In fact, it was something that I considered even in my own conversion. And the way I like to think about various apparitions and miracle claims, especially ones that are sort of well scrutinized, that have a lot of data that is, let's say, highly resistant to a naturalistic explanation, is to think of them as lending some evidential support, even if they aren't conclusive. So the way I think about it like this, sigh and gentle caller, is in terms of like hypothesis testing. We kind of be kind of scientific about it, right? So we can think, hey, if the God hypothesis is true, if God exists, what sort of things would we expect in the world to occur? And if the naturalistic story or the atheistic story is true, what sort of things would we expect in the world to occur? Well, I think it doesn't need to be heavily argued that if God exists, miracles are not only possible, but we should at least expect them occasionally. And we might even expect them as sort of motives of credibility or divine indicators that certain positions are actually true, right? And this is how the Catholic Church has thought about Fatima. There used to be an old apologetic school around this called motives of credibility or signs of credibility, right, where God gives occasional winks to let us know that we're on the right path, right, as Catholics or people should look at the Catholic Church or something like that. So there's all this data around Fatima. You explained some of it, right? There was accurate predictions made by the children. There was the miracle of the sun, right, this incredible meteorological mystery phenomena. And there was also, if I remember rightly, the like sudden and unexpected drying of the ground. And then there's all the newspaper reports of people there, many who were atheistic, saying, yeah, this really happened and I have no explanation for it. And of course, it was suffused. This is important. It was suffused with religious significance, right? It was suffused with religious significance. And one of the things that we should keep in mind when thinking about miracles and whether to even take a miracle claim seriously is whether it actually has some bearing on our lives in a deep existential sense or a religious sense, right? Because it would kind of seem weird that there would be a miracle that didn't serve some greater theological purpose, right? So I think one of the sort of criteria that we should hold to even want to look at the claim surrounding a miracle is what sort of religious or spiritual significance might it have. Fatima meets that criteria. It also meets the criteria of being sort of immediately documented by many, many eyewitnesses, right? So it's meeting various motives of credibility to a very high standard, right? And then it's going to be really hard to give a naturalistic explanation of all the data. You might be able to explain one point of the data, right? But you need to be able to explain all the data and the fact that they all kind of occurred in the time frame that they did. Now, what I'm saying here, what I'm setting up for is a more modest argument. What I'm saying is the whole God exists and the Catholic Church is true hypothesis, like, predicts or makes really great sense of the occurrence of Fatima. It's the sort of thing that fits into that worldview very, very nicely, right? Whereas it's not the sort of thing you would ever expect on an atheistic worldview. I mean, what kind of convoluted stories you have to throw together to try and make sense of all the data on Fatima? It's crazy, right? Especially if you're familiar with the details of it. And if people aren't, I suggest looking into it and doing more research on it. So what I say is that this is, to use some technical terminology, my friend Tyler McNabb has a paper on this. It's a C-inductive argument. So a C-inductive argument is some argument that should raise your confidence in a particular hypothesis to some degree, maybe not overwhelmingly, maybe not even to the point of you thinking it's more probable or not, but it definitely adds evidential weight in favor of that hypothesis, right? So minimally, I think what we should say is that Fatima is a sort of thing that should definitely increase our confidence that not only that God exists, but the Catholic Church is true, because Fatima is a distinctly Catholic miracle. So I think it's not only evidence for God, it's evidence for Catholicism specifically, especially all the doctrinal commitments that come along with it. Does that make sense, Cy? Did I explain that coherently?
It was very coherent to me. I wonder, Eric, what do you think? Does that seemed like how you wanted to use Fatima in your defense of God, Eric?
Well, I was entirely surprised I could follow all he said. And he did a good job, but, you know, I can't follow fast talkers, but it was a great answer, terrific answer.
I feel the same. I'm always surprised when Pat does a good job. I'm completely
you and me
you.
Both, Cy. Thank you, guys. It's very fun.
thanks, Eric. I really appreciate that. I mean, the thing that impresses me about the miracle of the sun at Fatima is the atheist journalists and the poets, that are like, I remember there's one Portuguese poet he's not even paying attention. He doesn't even know that this is supposed to happen that day. And he's a few miles away and he sees it like this. It's quite striking that this is not some weird case of mass delusion or something. That wouldn't explain at all what happened on that day.
Right. And that's important, because even if you could explain some of it with mass delusion, which I think is a sort of non-starter to begin with, because I don't think we have parallel examples of something on that scale, you still have to explain the accurate predictions, the prophecies, the drying of the ground, right?
Right? Yeah.
And now you're going to have to bring in auxiliary hypotheses, and now you're getting a really complicated theory, which is not good in terms of theory comparison, right? We want a simpler theory, right?
Yeah.
That's sort of the atheist presumption of one of their arguments. This, we should go with a simpler theory if explanations are equal. So even if a naturalist could get explanations on a par around Fatima, which I don't think they can, it's clear they can only do it by constructing a really complicated theory, right?
Yeah. Can I throw out one other? Because I get so. But people always think, well, the message of Fatima, a lot of it had to do with the Russian errors, but people forget that the last appearance at Fatima, the day of the dancing sun, was a month before the Red Army won the Civil War in Russia. It was a month before. And nobody expected the Red Army to win. Just read about it. You can go look it up. It was an utterly shocking victory. So even her saying Russia will spread its errors, I mean, if you just notice it, the calendar, this is 1 month before the rise of the victory of the Red Army in the Russian Civil War. Emma, thanks again, Eric. We're talking about God and whether or not it's rational to believe in God. If you are one who would like to challenge us on that, we love those conversations. We really do. And you're very welcome here. And we'll give you plenty of time to make your points. And we'll come back to you and check in to see if you have a counter argument. You'll be treated well, I promise you.
I'm nice.
And that's true as well. That also is true. So 888-318-7884. I'm going to Emma now in Hayden, Idaho, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Emma, nice to talk with you again. Go ahead with your question for
Pat. Thank you. She's back.
I
don't have a question, and these are not my words. Oh, Dennis Prager sent them. He said there is a burden of truth that has to fall on the atheist because the atheist cannot prove that there is no God. I was wondering what you thought about that.
Don't mention other radio programs when you come on here.
I'm sorry.
Hey, Emma, what are you doing? No, I'm teasing you,
That's
Emma.
That's the competition.
I'm sorry. All right, so Dennis Prager says there's a burden of proof on the atheist.
So, let's talk about this a bit, because this is actually a really important part of the debate. And Emma, thank you for calling, by the way. This is a really great topic, so I'm glad you brought it up. Oftentimes what you hear is actually sort of the opposite. The atheist, this is probably Mr. Prager, I guess, was responding to the common objection where the atheist will say, well, look, it's actually you have to prove to me that God exists. I don't have the burden of proof. Right. And then you get into this whole burden of proof debate, which I would like to talk about right now, because I think it's important. Why is it important? It's important because if you can help it, you kind of don't want the burden of proof, right? It's a burden. It's always sort of a lot harder to make a case than it is to be skeptical of something. I mean, let's be honest. We all know that it's much easier to kind of fold our arms and be skeptical of a position than it is to try and reasonably establish a position, and especially prove a position, right? So if we can help it, I think we shouldn't want the burden of proof if we're a theist. Now, it might be the case that we just do, and that's not the end of the world, because I think that there are really good reasons for believing in God, and I think we can shoulder that burden. But generally, I think it would be better if we could show that it's not super clear that theists have the burden of proof. Now, this debate is complicated, but let me give a smattering of initial thoughts, right? So why think that the theist has the burden of proof? Well, maybe one reason is the atheist will say, well, you hold a more complicated theory, right? Your world has more things in it than mine does, right? And since you're positing extra stuff, you should be the one that has to argue for that extra stuff. You know, you got God and angels and maybe ghosts and ghouls and pixies and who knows what else. And I don't have any of that, right? So if you want me to believe in your worldview, you got all this extra stuff, then prove it to me. You have the burden of proof, not me. All right, so let's call this the extra stuff motivation. I don't think it's a good one. Because if that really decided where the burden of proof is, we'd be dealing with a lot of difficulty concerning solipsis. Now, for those who aren't familiar, solipsism is the very strange philosophical position that only you exist, right? You're the only thing that actually exists. And everything else that you think exists is really just a sort of projection of your mind, a hallucination. So we could kind of take what the atheist just said and run it out the mouth of a solipsist. A solipsist will say, hey, you guys who are metaphysical realists, who actually think that there's a world outside of your head of independently existing things, you got all this extra stuff. You know, you've got real trees and real flowers and a real cycad. I don't have any of that. It's just me. I'm just a mind or a brain or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
And then that's it, right? That's it. So I have less stuff. You have more stuff. If you want me to accept more stuff, then you got to prove it to me. You have the burden of proof. Now, again, most of us think solipsism is not just false, but insane, right? If somebody is a solipsist, we think that they don't need philosophical argument. They need psychiatric treatment, right?
Yeah.
And I think that could be said about a number of philosophical positions. But it seems like if the more stuff motivation determines the burden of proof, that's gonna hurt us in ways that definitely seems false, right? One is, if solipsism was the default position, I mean, good luck, because it's actually pretty hard to argue against the solipsist, because the theory is like a grand conspiracy theory. It's designed to accommodate pretty much any data you could throw at it, right?
Right.
So then we have the burden of proof against a solipsist. No, that seems false. It seems like certainly solipsism has the burden of proof, right? This position is so strange, so unusual, so fantastic, so against common sense, intuition, seemings, all that, that if you're going to try and get me to be a solipsist, you have the burden of proof. So that's one way I think you can start to diffuse that. Another thing an atheist might say is, hey, theism is just really extraordinary, and extraordinary beliefs, you know, they require extraordinary evidence. And what I want to say to that is, well, in what sense is it extraordinary exactly? Because it's a very common belief. I mean, the vast majority of people believe in God. They always have. They do now. And I predict that they always will. Atheism is actually the sort of the anomaly in terms of belief. But I hear the music, so we'll have to continue this on the other side of the break. Sorry for the extent answer here.
No, that's good. Thanks, Emma. I appreciate it. You're welcome to call and talk about God's existence, whether you believe in God or do not, whether you want to argue with us or you'd like some help making the arguments. 888-318-7884. Right back with more Pat Flynn.
Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com. Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
What weakness have you overcome to be a better person?
Inspire us tomorrow on Take Two with Jerry and Debbie.
On most of these EWTN stations.
Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Emma called up and started out by mentioning another radio program. Come on, Emma. I mean, it's basic rules of radio. You don't call up and mention Dennis Prager. He's one of the most popular people on the radio. We can't compete with that. Don't mention him.
But no chance.
His argument was, like, the burden of proof for atheism is – I mean, the burden of proof regarding God is on the atheist, not the – theist or the believer, and you have dispelled a good amount of that, but she did make one other point that you had not addressed. You want to yes. address that now?
Yeah, so she mentioned not being able to prove a negative, which is often what the atheist will say is, hey, I don't have to prove to you that God doesn't exist because you can't prove a negative. And the short answer there is, yeah, actually, you can, right? If you show that the notion of God is contradictory and you think contradictions are impossible, then you can prove that God doesn't exist. And in fact, that's what many atheist philosophers try to do, right? They try to prove that God doesn't exist by showing that either God is sort of inherently contradictory, or say something about the world contradicts the nature of God, like evil. So certainly sophisticated atheists think you could prove the non-existence of God, or at least give a great amount of evidence against the existence of God. So I don't think that that's the wisest move to take. One other thing I said about extraordinariness, just to close that loop real quick, I think theism and atheism are both extraordinary at the end of the day. Yes, theism, you have to believe in God, and classical theism is a pretty awesome set of beliefs, no doubt about it. But atheism is a pretty awesome set of beliefs, too. You either have to think that everything came from nothing, or everything that seems like it should have an explanation has just always been there with no further explanation, and all that just seems really extraordinary to me. So extraordinariness just seems to me to be in the eye of the beholder, and that debate doesn't get you anywhere.
It's because it's an extraordinary universe we live in. Like, you can't right. get out of it without, I mean, nobody can make a perfect explanation of it. So you, at some point, you're going to have to make a decision about its nature. Am I correct in
right.
that or no? Yes?
It's sort of extraordinary that anything even exists. I mean, if I had to guess, I don't know how I would do that without existing. Does something exist or does something not exist, right? I guess my guess would be that something doesn't exist, right? But things do exist. That's really extraordinary.
Yeah, because right? Right, yeah. Yeah, it's
so
not just
crazy.
Things. It's a lot
about,
of
yeah.
things. We got to build spaceships and shoot them out right. to the Lagrange point, and then we look back, you know, 13, it's a, yeah. Well, why does all that
yeah,
exist?
Lagrange is an awesome ZZ Top song, by the way.
That is true. That is true, but that's a different Lagrange. That's
it is.
Lagrange,
it is.
Texas. I'm just impressed that I even use the word Lagrange. Stephen in San Diego.
That's why I had to pick it out. I was impressed.
Yeah, listening on the EWTN app. We also have a Catholic radio station, an EWTN radio station here in San Diego now, Stephen, 1450 a.m. Mm-hmm. I hope you'll dig that sometime, but go ahead with your question for Pat Flynn.
Yes, this is more of a comment, and I would like to see his take on it.
Okay.
I've been thinking that the complexity of life is against atheism, because the elements that conform every living thing do not have will, do not have intelligence, so they cannot decide to become more complex. On the contrary, they'd be more simple. A real snail cannot decide to grow wings one day and say, I need them, or they'll be good for me, for my my future survival. So that would be my take. I don't know what he thinks about that.
What do you think, Pat?
Yes.
Is there an argument for God in the complexity of life?
Yeah, really great question. Thank you for calling in, Stephen. So I want to say... yes, I think personally that there is a good reason to believe in God based on complexity. But I want to make a couple of distinctions and qualifications. There's kind of two different arguments for God in this camp of design arguments, right? There's the argument more traditionally known as the argument from teleology, or directedness or regularity within nature, right? Which doesn't require complexity per se. You could run that just from the natural directedness of one particle to another particle, or the natural directedness of an acorn towards becoming an oak tree, just any sort of natural directedness or regularity at all, or even a natural directedness of reason towards truth, if you want, right? I think those arguments are actually stronger, but they're more metaphysically complex, so they might not be as apologetically useful or accessible. Then you do have arguments, call them arguments from design or from complexity, and these are famously associated with William Paley, and are kind of more advocated by what is now known as intelligent design theorists, like people like Michael Behe and stuff like that. And while I do not think that all the arguments that come out of that camp are good, some I think are actually quite not good, I will say that even though I had an initially skeptical attitude towards them, after reading, engaging with the work of Michael Behe, I've changed my mind on that. I think he presents a particular case from irreducible complexity, if people are familiar with that, right? That you have this sort of functional composite, right? That is only functional insofar as all the parts are there and sort of coordinated in a certain way. And he thinks that this provides strong evidence against a naturalistic hypothesis, not, this is important, not that evolution has occurred, but how it has occurred. He doesn't think that selection working on random mutation could ever get to that level of functional complexity before everything could snap together and be functionally useful, right? How would you have selection getting to that point, right, when there's no real sort of functional utility up to it? I don't think it's compelling or dispositive by itself, but if we think of hypothesis testing, in what worldview would I be more likely to expect to see irreducibly complex systems where if you remove any one part, the whole thing sort of functionally collapses? I think it's obviously more likely in a worldview that has an intelligent agent behind it that can relate concepts and relate ideas and build very complex things, right? Because we have firsthand experience of the ability to do that from conscious rationality, right? Whereas I think it would be highly surprising to see those sorts of things if atheism were true or naturalism was true. That doesn't mean that they couldn't emerge, but that, again, the fact that we see them sort of in the actual world should cause us to think that that is evidence for a theistic hypothesis rather than an atheistic one. How much evidence? Yeah, you can argue about that. But I guess maybe we should even clarify what I think by a good argument. I guess if I think an argument gives me some fair amount of weight towards a particular position, then I guess I'm willing to call it a good argument. But that doesn't necessarily say that I think it's absolutely compelling or dispositive. Yeah. The debate's over after that. So I just want to be clear about how I'm presenting that, if that makes sense. Yeah.
Stephen, thanks very much. Our number here is 888-318-7884. Really haven't had, I don't believe, callers disagreeing with our commitment to the idea that God exists. And if you do disagree, we really would love to have that conversation. We have plenty of time to have that conversation still. So if you're willing to pick up the phone and call, Pat Flynn is our guest, and we'd love to have that chat. 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. I'm interested, Pat, in the way that thing that you just described right there, that often we come to our beliefs not because they are absolutely proven to us, but because there's a preponderance of evidence in that regard. So, like, I mean, I don't know. I've never proven to myself that gravity exists, or, you know, but I do believe that it's the thing that's keeping the moon going around. I mean, connected to the Earth. So, right. So, and I don't think I'm mentally capable of proving the existence or the reality of gravity. But so preponderance of evidence is not just a giving up. That's not just a giving up on being rational.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And this is sort of how Cardinal Newman thinks about assent, right? We come to assent to certain propositions, say, usually not just through one like cinching argument or one cinching consideration.
Right.
What it is it's a sort of stream of different considerations. Yeah, you've got some philosophical arguments here. You've got some historical evidence there. It makes sense of, it's the simplest theory that makes sense of the widest range of data. You've got personal experience, intuition, testimony. So you've got all these sort of converging lines of evidence, right, that are often sort of qualitatively different in many respects, right? But they're all sort of pushing you towards this particular commitment. And it's that convergence or that cumulative force that often is what gets us to consent. And I agree. That was how my own conversion was. It wasn't like I just stumbled upon just one argument for the existence of God and read it and was like, that's it, done with my old worldview, go into this one. You know, usually you scratch your chin, you go, that's interesting, I hadn't considered that before, and maybe I'll want to consider it deeper and see if there's any other arguments or if there's any other evidence or any other reasons. And at some point, you feel that the evidential scales start to tip, right? And
yeah,
it's when they start to tip that you begin to move from doubt to assent. That's right. Mm-hmm. That's how it works for most people, anyways. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and maybe too much of looking for that killer argument gets us away from evidence that we should be just willing to refer to that evidence, not necessarily trying to prove someone wrong in their view.
Yes. I think that's so true. One is because why assume such a burden on yourself, right?
It's really, oh, that's a good point.
It's really hard to prove things.
Yeah.
But it's also just like psychologically unrealistic. I mean, whoever changes their mind on a position, especially if it's a position that sort of like deeply entangled in their personal history. It's got all sorts of emotional entanglements, right? Whoever changes their mind on the spot on a radio show because of one single argument, right? Rather, I like to kind of give a list of, hey, here's a bunch of reasons that I think it's reasonable to believe in God. God makes the best sense of the fact that there's any contingent thing, of physical fine tuning, of biological complexity, of teleology, of rationality, of consciousness, of near-death experiences, of apparitions, of various scientifically scrutinized miracle claims, of the historical data surrounding the resurrection of Christ, the endurance of the Catholic Church. All that sort of stuff is just the sort of thing I would expect on the hypothesis that I hold now, the God hypothesis, the Catholic hypothesis, if you will. And it's extremely surprising. I would not expect to see any of that if naturalism were true. And so it's, yeah, all of that together just makes me really, really think that the God hypothesis is the right one, right?
I'm grateful that some folks calling that disagree with that position, because we wanted to have that conversation. So we'll do that right after this. We'll get back to the phones. Pat Flynn, our guest, we're talking about whether or not it's reasonable to believe in God.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
He is honored by the Church as a saint with the title of the Seraphic Doctor.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
One of the greatest theologians and Franciscan mystics in church history, Bonaventure also wrote a biography of St. Francis that was commissioned by the Franciscans themselves. It took a saint and true mystic to understand a true saint and mystic. He died in 1274.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
We have a big problem. Our culture is dying, and souls are in danger of being lost. The answer is conversion to Jesus Christ in His church. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a Catholic organization, and we have hundreds of teams spreading the good news throughout the country. But we need your help. The harvest is great, but the laborers are few. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Today's program is sponsored by the number 45. At least that's what Carrie told me. That's because we have just 45 days until the kickoff of this year's Catholic Answers Conference. There's a bunch of great reasons to come. Among them, we're going to do the live broadcast of this program there twice. We'll do it Thursday and Friday afternoons from the conference. The great speakers, another reason, the fact that the topic is Jesus, and our bishop has allowed us to reserve the Eucharist, so there'll be a Eucharistic adoration, and you can spend as much time as you'd like with Jesus while you're there. You also spend as much time as you like with Jimmy Akin. So those are two wonderful people. Just go to CatholicAnswersConference.com right now to register. I wasn't trying to make a moral equivalency if it sounded like that. They both are wonderful people, but I wasn't trying to. I don't want to make Jimmy uncomfortable. Lewis in Missouri, you are next. Lewis listening on 91.5 FM. Go ahead, Lewis, with your thoughts for Pat Flynn.
Yeah, thanks. It's not around the word believe. Belief is not enough. 300 years ago, they believed that there was witches and burned women at the stake. I could tell you I believed in experienced a UFO sighting or taken up an aircraft. The only problem with those kind of stories is, well, did you bring anything back to show as evidence? Or, for example, Bigfoot, a guy swore he saw Bigfoot. So he went back to the area, collected hair samples. Turned out Bigfoot was half cow and half bear. The Bible is an ancient text, but it's just hearsay.
Okay.
And at that time, before science came into play, the Bible was not questioned. That was the best thing we had going at the time. But only 120 years ago in this country, women would die giving birth and their baby too. They didn't know to wash their hands. Or only a generation ago, polio hit this country. There was no immunization shots. And the reason the explosion of knowledge and information is communication, phone, internet, faster travel. And that was all done by man. But the answer to it, no one knows. atheists are saying with logic and reason, I don't know. It's implied that, well, do you have a better story? Well, no, I'm not going to make up one. I would like to wait till we may never know what caused all this.
All right, let's get Pat to respond, and then I'll come back to you, and we'll make a conversation of it. Does that sound all right?
Yeah, there's a lot there, Lewis, and I appreciate your call, and I appreciate your thoughts. So let me just say, let me try and take it somewhat in actually reverse order. So if we're talking today about the existence of God, the sort of reliability of Scripture and whether it accurately reports facts on the ground is not entirely relevant. There's important connections between the two, but it certainly could be the case that the Bible just is hearsay, but that God exists and we just have a false instance of revelation. I don't think that's true, but the question of God's existence is actually, in a sense, quite independent. And it's important that when we're kind of doing various philosophical investigations that we disentangle things that are not logically connected. So the existence of God, classical theism, is not necessarily connected with the truth of Christianity. We know this because there are many different religious beliefs that affirm classical theism, such as Hinduism, for example, that are not Christian, right? So one could believe in God and not think that the Bible is the inspired word or something like that. You mentioned a bunch of things that I just don't see are sort of immediately relevant, like polio vaccines, to whether the Bible is a reliable source of information. And there I just want to say that even quite skeptical scholars don't say what you're saying. They don't say that it's hearsay, right? They might not believe a number of the claims that are made in the Bible, but they certainly think that it conveys accurate information to a considerable extent. Now, why is that? Well, because the reporting of the Bible meets certain criteria, right, that historians want to be met to determine whether a historical document is reliable, right? Eyewitness testimony, proximity to the facts, embarrassing details are admitted, right? A lack of various pressures to fabricate accounts, right? So it meets all these different criteria that are markers of credibility for historians, right? That doesn't prove the resurrection or something like that, but it does show that if you're going to sort of cast a general doubt on Scripture, right, as conveying accurate facts, or it's something we can't know, I think you're going to really take down a lot of what we think is historical knowledge with it. And that seems to me to be too skeptical of a stance to take. But I want to go back again to kind of a theme of this episode and tie it in to maybe to show how I think God's existence can actually sort of prime us to see that Scripture is itself extremely good evidence for the truth of Christianity and the resurrection of Christ. Now, I can only give a sketch here because we're limited on time, but it'll show, I think, the importance that philosophy plays in belief formation, because we always sort of come to data, including history, with a particular philosophical lens on. We always have operative assumptions in the background, right? For example, if you're an atheist, I can say when I was an atheist, I never even really paid much attention to the Christian claims because I thought miracles were impossible. So if anything's claiming miracles, I'm just not even going to pay attention to it. Whereas if you're a theist and you think miracles are at least in principle on the table, you might want to look at some of the evidence for it. But consider this, right? Consider that God exists and that he created the world and that there are human beings and stuff like that. Do we think that there's reason that God would give revelation? And if he is going to give revelation, like how would he give it? Would he give it to just like every individual and sort of like an instant and infused knowledge, or would he give it to a sort of community and moral community? And I want to say that God certainly would give us revelation, especially if there's an afterlife and there's certain things that we need to know that are really important to building a moral character in this life that will sort of determine the next slice of our existence, if you will. If we think that God exists and is all good, I think we can have a really strong expectation that God is going to reveal to us things that are essential, right, for the most important things in life, our eternal salvation and so on and so forth. So I think we could expect a revelation philosophically by just thinking about the nature of God. And Sai, we've talked about this before. I think the incarnation actually is something that makes perfect sense given certain philosophical backgrounds, that God is all good, God is all loving, that something's kind of gone wrong, that there's an original sin, that God would seek to reunite us with himself by actually becoming one of us. It's such a beautiful story. But I would say good philosophy should actually sort of prime you to expect something like the Christian story. And if that's the case, the actual evidence you need on the ground to reasonably believe it is significantly lessened, right? So think about this in any other instance, right? If you already have prior expectations, take a murder scene, for example, right? And say that there's a suspect and his name is John. And we think, did John commit the murder or he did not? And there's not like a whole bunch of evidence on the scene. Maybe there's like partial fingerprints and stuff like that. But it's nothing that like by itself would convince a completely neutral person. But what if you had prior expectations, right? What if you knew in sort of your background knowledge that John had done stuff like this before? He had written a letter to somebody else saying he was going to do something like this. He's of a certain moral character. This is somebody he's had a long-standing vendetta with. The point is if you have prior expectations, right, that point towards a particular outcome, the actual on-the-scene evidence you need to reasonably affirm that outcome is significantly lessened. So the point I'm trying to make, which I go much more in-depth on in a recent podcast I did with a friend of mine named Joshua Siduati, is that good philosophy should prime you for something like Christian revelation. And once that's in place, I think the amount of evidence we have on the scene historically that meets good historical criteria is absolutely strong enough for reasonable assent. Reasonable assent, not proof. Didn't say proof, but reasonable assent. And that's the way I like. That's the way I like to phrase it, Si.
Well, Lewis, thank you for hanging on. Would you have a response or anything you'd like to add, Lewis?
Well, yeah, that is a good point. Now, it was used to be believed that a witness was the best evidence, as we all well know, it's not. And that science brings out absolute truth. Now, the law enforcement say, well, we didn't see it. That's the first thing they'll say in an accident scene or a murder scene. We didn't see it. So they have two separate groups. One investigates the physical evidence and use science and laws of, physics, thermodynamics. Then they go to the witnesses, but they interview the witnesses separately. Let's say there's 10 witnesses. I call it running a lying contest. They'll say 100 different things, and then they'll say 5 things between the 10 of them. And so they meet in the middle, and they say, okay, what theory did you base what happened here on the evidence? Well, they didn't see it. So they base it on the physical evidence. And then do the witnesses corroborate what the evidence shows? But you can't have a witness before the evidence. And they certainly wouldn't call a pastor at a church, and he has a cell phone number to the God, and we'll get the answer there. No, that is nowhere can that be in the nature of reality.
Pat?
Yeah, so first off, we rely on the witnesses of the scientific experiments, right? So I don't think we want to undercut witness testimony entirely, because we're going to have a trouble with appealing to scientific authorities and saying that we really know things through science, especially since we didn't run the vast majority, if any, of those scientific experiments ourselves. So witness testimony, all this is epistemologically non-negotiable, including and especially for science. Now, you bring up a good point, Lewis, that just a witness isn't necessarily always the best reason to affirm something. But that's not the case, again, with the New Testament. And that's why historians look at various different criteria. How many witnesses were there? Was it a public event that many people witnessed, or was it just one individual claiming something? Were some of the witnesses politically motivated to affirm it or disaffirm it? And that's where we have good examples with somebody like St. Paul, for example, who seemed to have he was a murderer of Christians, right? And every sort of prior reason not to attest to this. So he's what we might call a hostile witness. So it's the sort of collection of witnesses, right? And the sort of prior stance of those witnesses that helps people to determine whether we think that the general witness, the collective witness, should be reliable. And I'll just keep going back to the point that, yeah, that's certainly that criteria is met when it comes to scripture. And if you don't think that that is a good criteria, you're going to lose a lot more knowledge than just historical and scriptural knowledge, because that is how epistemology and belief formation works all over the place, and including often in the sciences as well.
Mm-hmm. Lewis, I got to leave it there because we're about to end this hour, and I got to thank Pat for his time with us. But Lewis, thanks very much. It's always wonderful when we get to have the conversations between people across a divide rather than just affirming one another. So that was very, very helpful to us, and we appreciate that you took the time to do it, Lewis. I hope maybe you'll call again sometime. Pat Flynn, I do have to thank you for another very fine hour, even though the four of your five children keep you awake at night.
Well, God bless them. I wouldn't trade it for anything. Si, thank you so much for having me on, and thank you to all the callers. It was a tremendous time, as always.
Where can people find you on the internet?
Yeah, thank you so much. Well, I have a YouTube channel called Philosophy for the People, which I think would be most relevant for them. So if they're into this sort of thing, come subscribe. Philosophy for the People on YouTube, hosted by myself and Jim Madden.
Thanks, Pat. And I'm looking forward to a lot more collaborations with you as an associate here at Catholic Answers, something we're very proud of. So I like to keep saying it. Hey, next hour, William Albrecht's going to be here. We're going to talk about the Assumption of Mary. And, you know, the feast day is not a good day to do the controversy. So we're doing it a week from the feast. And if this whole Catholic thing about the Assumption of Mary doesn't sit quite right with you, whether you're Catholic or not, hang on for the next hour. Maybe give us a call right after this.